The headlines. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani rules out any changes or additions of new members to the 2015 nuclear deal. The Italian President tasks former European Central Bank Chief Mario Draghi with forming a new government. And security remains tight in the Indian capital, New Delhi, amid protests over the government's agricultural policies. Hello, welcome. 5:30 p.m. Iran's capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Iran's president says the United States should comply with the UN Security Council resolution that endorsed the 2015 nuclear deal.
The Americans should know that they have so far violated UN Security Council Resolution 2231. It's not a matter of Iran and its nuclear deal. I'm telling the Americans that it is Resolution 2231 that is the issue. It is a resolution unanimously approved by the UN Security Council.
President Rouhani reiterated if the U.S. respects the law and fulfills its obligations, Iran will fully abide by its commitments also. He said there is no point saying that Iran should return to the nuclear deal, as the country never left it. Iran's president also said no provision of the accord will change and no new member will join it whatsoever. He said it's widely believed in the world that the Iran deal can be beneficial for international security, peace, and unity. In 2018, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the accord and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Political commentator John White says that the new U.S. administration has to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and compensate the Iranian nation for the harm that it has caused.
I don't think they go far enough, actually. I think the Iranians are well within their rights to be demanding compensation from the Biden administration for the harm done to the Iranian economy as a result of the Trump administration's to pull out of the JCPOA, or the Iran deal, in 2018. I think Biden should approach the Iranians with contrition and a spirit of humility on the understanding that Trump's decision to pull out unilaterally from this internationally agreed diplomatic deal negotiated with five different countries, a violation of international law and all norms of diplomacy. And I think the Biden administration has to come to the Iranian government with that in mind and offer some compensation, because the Iranian people have suffered enormously from these sanctions since Trump reimposed them and tightened them from 2018 onwards.
The International Court of Justice is set to rule on whether it can take on Iran's bid to overturn U.S. economic sanctions. The ruling is expected on Wednesday. Tehran filed this lawsuit in mid-2018 after the U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and reinstated sanctions. Tehran accused Washington of breaching a 1955 bilateral treaty and destroying millions of lives. The U.S. top court previously ruled that the U.S. should lift the sanctions. Washington, however, said the Hague-based court does not have jurisdiction over the case. If the court decides to take on Iran's bid, a final ruling could be months or years away. It was in the year 2019 that Iran's leader issued a statement to describe the achievements of the Islamic Revolution in the past four decades, outlining the second phase of the revolution and its necessities. One year after, an international conference was held on the topic. Humayun Abadi attended the second edition of this conference, which is dubbed the School of General Qasem Soleimani.
2 years ago, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, enumerated the achievements of the 1979 Islamic Revolution in the last 40 years and presented recommendations toward the goal of making a great Islamic Iran. Since then, several events have been held to elaborate on the details of the second step of the revolution. Press TV was invited to the Imam Hussein University of Tehran to attend the second conference on the topic, which was held with a focus on General Qasem Soleimani's school.
The main goal of this conference is the realization of the second phase of the Islamic Revolution. This statement is to globalize the Islamic Revolution of Iran. It envisages the prospects of advancement of the revolution in its second 40 years to reach the new Islamic civilization. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution stated, General Qasem Soleimani must be seen as a school of thought, and the managers to be trained for the second phase of the revolution need to follow him as a role model.
Hundreds of scholars, researchers, and managers will attend special workshops to get familiar with the objectives of the second step of the revolution.
Over 40 universities from across the country, as well as some international universities, started to elaborate on the leaders' statement on the second phase of the revolution since last year. The results of their efforts would be unveiled at this conference. Moreover, the managers will learn how to use General Soleimani's thoughts in the economy, lifestyle, justice, and fight against corruption.
Nearly 10,000 people have already registered to participate in the conference virtually. Over 300 papers were sent to the secretariat of the Second International Conference of the Second Phase of Iran's Revolution, and out of them, 80 of the best papers will be presented at different panels. Human Abedi, Tehran.
There are reports coming out of Lebanon saying that an Israeli drone has exploded above the country's south. A local Lebanese broadcaster, NBN, reported the incident while an unnamed security source said the unmanned aircraft was shot down. The Israeli military says missiles were fired at the drone but did not hit it. Earlier this week, Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah said it downed an Israeli drone after it violated the Arab nation's airspace. The Israeli military has recently intensified its violations of the Lebanese airspace as part of what Hezbollah calls an ongoing spy operation against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over the Lebanese territory. Two drones downed in 2 days, both belonging to Israel. One of them was brought down by Palestinian resistance forces in the Gaza Strip on Tuesday. Another was downed in Lebanon 1 day earlier. The resistance movement Hezbollah said it has shot down the drone after it violated Lebanese airspace.
Hezbollah said it shot down an Israeli drone near the border town of Blida. The downing of the drone comes as the Israeli military has recently intensified its violations of the Lebanese airspace as part of what Hezbollah calls an ongoing spying operation against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over the Lebanese territory. But Tel Aviv's frequently violating Lebanon's airspace is seen by many as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and the country's sovereignty.
I think that Israel really is disregarding territorial sovereignty in general in Lebanon, in Gaza, and other places as well, Syria, Iraq. Israel has bombed militia in Iraq, and it's also involved its attack of forces in Libya as well. So I don't think that Israel really cares about honoring international protocols, international law. It just, at will violate any country's territory as long as it feels it's in its interest to do so. And I think it's been violating Lebanese territory for decades, really.
But such Israeli violations are not limited to Lebanon. On Tuesday, Palestinian resistance forces downed an Israeli drone in southern Gaza and took control of it. The Israeli military confirmed one of its drones crashed in Gaza, but claimed there was, quote, no danger of information leak. On Sunday, Palestinian fighters also shot down an Israeli quadcopter, which was conducting an espionage mission over Beit Hanun crossing in Gaza's northern border with the occupied territories. The Israeli military frequently uses drones over the Gaza Strip either to monitor and photograph Palestinian military units or bomb specified targets.
It uses drones regularly in Lebanon, I think, too, and in the Gaza Strip. It uses them for intelligence gathering. It's trying to watch what people do in those places. It's looking for militant activities that could be construed as, building missiles. It's looking for people that might be building tunnels under Gaza to defend Gaza in the next battle invasion from Israel. So these drones are an important intelligence tool for Israel. And drones are important intelligence tools for all the countries that make drones, the United States as well, and in countries where it's involved in the Middle East.
The downing of the Israeli drones in Palestinian and Lebanese territories brings this question. Is the Israeli regime ready to wage a war? No, according to a top Israeli general. Back in 2018, this general said the Israeli military had invested most of its resources in the Air Force, while neglecting the land core. He said that had left Israel vulnerable to Hezbollah. Now, if the downing of the drones is anything to go by, then Israel has failed in its investment there. That means no matter how much money goes into the Israeli military's air power, intelligence, and cyber warfare, it would be insufficient to protect the regime. And this statement comes from an Israeli general that the regime needs ground superiority to win any war.
Israel does not only use drones to sneak into the Lebanese airspace. Its U.S.-made F-35 stealth jets have also violated the country's airspace multiple times. In late January, Lebanese media said the Israeli regime used F-35 and F-15 warplanes to fly over the cities of Nabatiya, Eqlimat Tufa, and Tyre. They said it was the first time F-35 jets were used on such missions and that the flights were conducted at high altitude. Israeli aircraft has routinely breached the Lebanese airspace since 2000 when the regime was forced by Hezbollah to withdraw from Lebanon's south. The Lebanese government has filed hundreds of protest letters with the UN over airspace violations by Israel since the 2000 withdrawal. The letters have failed in ending Israel's almost daily breaching of Lebanon's sovereignty. Observers say Tel Aviv's overflights could be meant to send a message to Lebanon.
Well, I think that Israel views Hezbollah in Lebanon as a prime rival and a prime opponent. So Israel continuously sends its F-16s and F-35s over Lebanon. It also sends them up to attack Syria. So I think that I don't know that they're sending a message about the drones, but I think that they really want to track what Hezbollah is doing. They want to find out what plans it has. They want to track any missiles that may be coming through Syria into Lebanon so that they can keep track of that for the next time that there's a war, an invasion by Israel of Lebanon.
Israel has waged numerous wars against regional countries since it was installed in West Asia following World War II. The regime enjoys full support from its Western creators, most notably the U.S., Britain, and France. The U.S. alone has used its veto power at the U.N. Security Council many times to shield Tel Aviv from the full force of international law. This has further emboldened the regime to continue down the path it started in 1948.
The Italian president has tasked former European Central Bank chief Mario Draghi with forming a new government as the country struggles with multiple crises. Draghi says he is confident of executing the job.
I thank the president for the trust he has placed in me, giving me the mandate to form a new government. It is a difficult moment. The president has spoken about the dramatic health crisis and its grave effects on the lives of people, on the economy, on society. The seriousness of the emergency demands answers that are up to the task. It is with this hope and this dedication that I have accepted the president's appeal.
Draghi made the remarks after meeting with President Sergio Mattarella. He will now hold consultations with different political parties and parliaments and is expected to lead a national unity government. Draghi's name emerged as a potential pick for premiership in recent weeks amid political turmoil in Italy, combined with health and economic emergencies. The ruling coalition of former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte collapsed last month after his predecessor Matteo Renzi pulled his Italia Viva party out of the alliance. They accused Conte of mishandling the health emergency and the subsequent economic crisis. Max Civilli is a correspondent joining us from Rome. You know, we only have a few minutes, Max, but I have so many questions to ask you. First of all, how did this name come about, the former ECB chief, to be nominated for this position and then for him to eventually get it?
Well, Draghi had largely vanished from the public eye since his mandate as president of the European Central Bank ended after 8 years in 2019. But his name emerged as a potential prime minister as soon as the government crisis sparked in mid-January. Draghi is credited with saving the euro after the 2008 debt crisis and for building the European Central Bank into a much more powerful institution. Now, the challenges he's facing are multiple. If he becomes Italy Prime Minister. In addition to tackling the COVID-19 pandemic, speeding up the vaccination process, it will have to implement projects to make good use of over 200 billion euros Italy is set to get in grants and low interest loans from the recovery fund, from the European Union's recovery fund. And furthermore, this year Italy holds the G20 presidency and it's co-chairing the COP26 UN Climate Summit with the United Kingdom. So now Draghi checking, is seeing if an eventual executive led by him would have a working majority in the parliament, and in the next few days we'll know if he's up to the task.
Well, here's the thing. When you take a look at his credentials, obviously, as you mentioned, we can take a look at how he operated as the ECB president and in terms of how you termed it, saving the euro. But do you think that qualifies him to run the country in any sense? Because there's so many things that every country has, and now with the pandemic, that just puts all the challenges in another dimension, really.
Look, I think that's the only option Italy has for now, because basically Italy is battered by the coronavirus and an economic crisis, but it's also risking to fail to grasp more than 200 billion euros from the recovery fund. And so the country desperately needs to secure that liquidity injection to counter the devastating impact of the pandemic. And Rome is due to submit its final plan to Brussels for approval by mid-April. And Draghi is the only man that can do it, because elections is the option to avoid. That's something that President Mattarella argued and said last night. It would take too much to actually organize the elections, the campaigns. And so Draghi is the only option that currently Italy as a country has to secure that huge fund of 200 billion euros from the European Union.
Okay, very well. Thank you for that. Max Civelli, a correspondent there from Rome. Germany has condemned the conviction of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny, demanding a halt to the use of police force against protesters in the country. A spokesman for Chancellor Angela Merkel called the sentencing of Navalny to 3.5 years in prison lawless. While warning of further sanctions, he said that Germany also condemns the systematic use of force against opposition protesters in Russia. Other Western governments and rights groups have also slammed the verdict against Navalny and the rest of his supporters. This is while Kremlin has backed police actions against what it calls unauthorized rallies. Navalny was arrested last week after returning from Germany, where he had been receiving treatment for alleged poisoning in Russia. He has been handed down the jail term for violating his parole from a 2014 suspended sentence. And that is World News.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Experts found homicide rates in the United States jumped by 30% from 2019 to 2020, whilst gun assault and aggravated assault rates climbed 8% and 6% respectively, calling the 30% surge a large and troubling increase that has no modern precedent. The report states, homicide rates were higher during every month of 2020 relative to rates from the previous year. We now present you an article written by Stephanie Pagones under the heading, Study Says America's Murder Rate Increase in 2020 Has No Modern Precedent. The article has been published by the New York Post. Please stay with us for more of Stephanie Pagones' article.
Welcome
According to a new study released recently, murder rates in the United States saw a historic increase in 2020 compared to 2019, with more than 1,200 additional killings year over year in a sample of 34 American cities. A report from the National Commission of COVID-19 and Criminal Justice states, the coronavirus pandemic, continuing incidents of police violence, and rising homicide and violent crime rates each pose massive policy challenges in their own right, but the interplay between them creates even more difficult decisions for policymakers. The report added, despite this difficulty, leaders at all levels of government should take bold action in responding to all three crises. Experts found homicide rates jumped by as much as 30% from 2019 to 2020, while gun assault and aggravated assault rates climbed 8% and 6% respectively. Calling the 30% surge a large and troubling increase that has no modern precedent, the report states, homicide rates were higher during every month of 2020 relative to rates from the previous year. Experts analyzed the data from as many as 34 U.S. cities, which varied in size and population, for year-over-year changes in 10 different areas of crime for the year-end update of a report called Pandemic, Unrest, Crime, and Violence in U.S. Cities. In addition to the three offenses listed above, the report examined the rates of domestic violence, robbery, residential burglary, non-residential burglary, larceny, motor vehicle theft, and drug offenses. The rates of homicides, motor vehicle thefts, gun assaults, and aggravated assaults rose year over year. Meanwhile, analysts found those related to drug offenses, larcenies, non-residential burglaries, residential burglaries, and robberies all decreased during the pandemic and during the year as a whole compared to 2019. Not every city provides the same kind of data, of course, and sample sizes for certain types of offences were smaller than others. As for domestic violence, analysts were only able to examine data from 12 US cities. They found that there was a significant increase in these types of offences during the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic, but the rate then levelled out to be roughly the same as it was in 2019. The average population of the cities whose homicide rates were examined was 978,000, but the cities range in size. The report states the largest city in the sample, New York City, boasts a population of approximately 8.42 million people, whilst the smallest city in the study, Norfolk, Virginia, has a population of 245,000. Analysts examined cities' aggravated assault rates to find that they were, on average, just over 6% higher than in 2019, with 6,741 more instances in 2020 than compared to the previous year. Meanwhile, experts reviewed the gun assault data of 15 U.S. cities and found that the rate climbed nearly 8%, with 3,557 more offenses. In terms of homicides, the report examined only those that were criminal in nature and defined homicides as being deliberate and unlawful killings of one human being by another. Analysts found that homicide rates, like most other crimes examined, follow a clear cylindrical pattern over time, rising during the summer months and falling in the autumn and winter. But in 2020, murder rates exceeded previous rates throughout the entire year. The report states, There was a structural break in the city average murder rate in June, indicating a large statistical significant increase in rates after adjusting for seasonality and a longer-term trend. The report added, after this break, homicide rates increased sharply throughout July and then declined through the end of the year, though not to levels observed in the prior year. January and February 2020 saw a combined homicide rate increase of 32.5% compared to the same time in 2019. March through to May saw a 19.4% surge, whilst June through to August experienced a 37.2% rate increase, and September through to December reported a 28.2% spike year over year. Analysts found that the pandemic likely temporarily suppressed some murders because it limited opportunities for offenders and victims to interact. But as COVID-19 related restrictions were slowly lifted or public concern waned in the spring and summer months, homicide rates again rose. Despite the decrease during the height of the COVID-19 shutdowns, analysts believe the pandemic may have increased the commission of homicides in multiple ways. Experts found the pandemic disproportionately affected vulnerable populations by creating more stress, whether physical, mental, or financial. It also further strained those groups and institutions tasked with responding to or treating violent crimes, such as police, hospitals, emergency medical services, community groups, and courts of law. The report notes, COVID-related restrictions may have had an initial suppressive effect on homicides, but the waning of those restrictions, coupled with the strain on at-risk individuals and key institutions, aggravated further by the lack of outreach to such individuals, have all likely contributed to elevated homicide rates in 2020. Analysts also noted a precipitous rise in murders during the emergence of civil unrest and protests following George Floyd's death, but added, the connection between police violence, protests and social unrest and heightened community violence remains uncertain. They also said they have found so far that no simple connection exists between the trio. In all, the National Commission of COVID-19 and Criminal Justice found homicide rates in 2020 were 30% higher than in the year before, with 1,268 more murders in the 34-city sample alone. Murders rose in 29 of the 34 cities examined, or 85% of the cities. The experts wrote, homicides increased in nearly all of the 34 cities in the sample. They added, in the author's view, urgent action is necessary to address these rapidly rising rates. Subduing the pandemic, increasing confidence in the police and the justice system, and implementing proven anti-violence strategies will be necessary to achieve a durable peace in the nation's cities. The report notes that the federal government will provide a final determination when it releases its official year-end crime statistics in the coming months. It also notes that whilst a one-year increase is cause for concern, the absolute homicide rate remains well below historical highs, adding, in 2020, in sample cities, the homicide rate was 11.4 deaths per 100,000 residents. 25 years earlier, in 1995, the rate for the same sample was 19.4 deaths per 100,000 residents. The report states, and several of the starkest increases were reported in smaller cities with very small homicide counts, where even a few additional homicides can produce a large percentage change. The experts wrote, but the large increases in homicides were not limited to smaller cities. The report found that in Chicago, Illinois, there were 278 more murders in 2020, which equated to a 55% surge year over year. Whilst in New York City's 131 added homicides accounted for a 43% surge compared to 2019 levels. The experts wrote, the three largest cities in our study, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, accounted for fully 40% of the 1,268 additional people killed in 2020. The report added, whilst there is variation among the cities, what is most notable is that homicide rose substantially in the vast majority of them.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام وجدت في الكتاب يعني كتابا لعلي عليه السلام أن قيمة كل امرئ وقدره معرفته إن الله تبارك وتعالى يحاسب الناس على قدر ما آتاهم من العقول في دار الدنيا.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, I found written in the book which is ascribed to Imam Ali alayhi salam that the worth and value of every man is his knowledge. Verily, Allah, blessed and most high, will take people to account according to his intellects that he has given them in this world's life.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, talking about the golden dialogues and very beautiful conversations which we find in the historical texts of Islam, we run across one very beautiful dialogue which is between Jabir bin Yazid and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now, Jabir bin Yazid is a very knowledgeable student. He is a wise companion of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. It is interesting, but when the student is a companion and the student is knowledgeable, then the teacher begins to teach things which he might not teach other students who are at a lesser point of knowledge and wisdom. And so in this conversation, we find that Imam al-Baqir actually puts forth very beautiful and very profound statements in this conversation. And this also shows us that Jabir al-Jufi was not just a regular companion of Imam al-Baqir. He must have been a very special companion of the Imam because of the beautiful and profound things that are exchanged in this conversation. One of the things that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says to Jabir al-Jufi in this truly golden conversation is that there is no obedience like performing the obligations. You know, dear friends, there are times where we think that we want to do something to obey Allah. We want to do something to be good servants, good creations of Allah. And, you know, sometimes we just don't know what to do. Well, here Imam al-Baqir, in this conversation with Jabir al-Jufi, tells us that the best kind of obedience of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, is that we perform our obligations, we perform our wajibat. And if we perform our wajibat, our obligations, our duties, our responsibilities as we should, then this is what is called obedience. Beautiful words exchanged in this golden conversation between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
When we look at the akhlaq of Imam alayhi salam, then you come to know that, according to narrations, Imam used to treat his family and friends very well. Whenever a family member would visit Imam, he would be fed well, clothed well, be given gifts, and so on and so forth. And similarly with the family. And Imam made it very clear, and he said, this dunya, the beauty of it is for you to share with your family members and your friends and make sure you are closer to them. And his akhlaq made many people to be attracted by him and the madhab of Ahlul Bayt. For example, one narration says there was one particular individual who was not a Muslim, but he used to live with Muslims. He came and he called Imam, Anta Baqir, Anta Baqara, oh Baqar, Baqar, Suratul Baqara. Baqara means cow. So he called Imam, you are a cow. Wallah, for us, we would fight. We wouldn't allow that to happen to us, or at least you use a foul language. But Imam alayhi salam said, no, I'm not Baqar. I am Baqir. I am Baqir. Then he continued. He said, Anta ibn Tabakha. You are a son of that woman whose only work is just to cook. Imam alayhi salam said, oh, dhaka khirfatuha. That is her profession. So what's wrong with that? If she cooks, that's her profession. Then he continues, he said, Ya Ibn Sauda, oh, the son of that black woman, Azinjiya, a zinj, ex-slave, Al-Badhiya, evil woman. This, for Imam, it was too heavy. Lakin Imam alayhi salam said, In kunta sadaqta, Ghafarallahu laha. In kunta sadaqta aw sadaqta. If you are saying the truth, Ghafarallahu laha. May Allah forgive my mom. If she did whatever wrong, may Allah forgive her. Wa in kunta kadhabta. And if you are saying something which is not true, you are lying, Ghafarallahu lak. May Allah forgive you. End of story. Allah. This particular individual was attracted by this. And after some time, he came to Imam, he apologized, and he said, "Wow, I'm sorry, I was wrong. I want to become a Muslim." And he accepted Islam. He became a Muslim because of the akhlaq of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
In the limelight.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is preparing to resume deportations of asylum seekers after a Trump-appointed Texas judge ruled against a 100-day suspension ordered by President Joe Biden. The ruling, in response to a challenge from a leading figure in the Republican effort to overturn the election result, marks the first shot in a legal rearguard action by Trump loyalists intended to stymie the Biden administration's agenda. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Julian Borger. The piece is titled, U.S. to Resume Deporting Asylum Seekers After Judge Rejects Biden Order. Stay with us for more of Julian Borger's article. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is preparing to resume deportations of asylum seekers after a Trump-appointed Texas judge ruled against a 100-day suspension ordered by President Joe Biden. The ruling, in response to a challenge from a leading figure in the Republican effort to overturn the election result, marks the first shot in a legal rearguard action by Trump loyalists intended to stymie the Biden administration's agenda. Human rights activists said the resumption of flights also raised the question of whether Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, who have been accused of systematic abuse of migrants and detainees, might seek to resist the new administration's efforts to reform the agency. An Immigration and Customs Enforcement plane left San Antonio, Texas for Port-au-Prince in Haiti on Monday morning, carrying Haitians detained on the U.S.-Mexican border and expelled under a highly controversial ICE interpretation of public health laws. Deportation flight to Haiti on the first day of the Black History Month, Guerlain Joseph, co-founder of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, wrote in a text to The Guardian, "What a slap in the face of the Haitian people." According to activists, there are also 23 Africans facing deportation from an Immigration and Customs Enforcement holding facility in Alexandria, Louisiana, as early as Tuesday, including 11 Angolans, 7 Cameroonians, 2 Congolese, and 3 others of unknown nationalities. Although the Haitian flight would probably have gone ahead even under the Biden moratorium, the expected African flight defies that order, as well as guidelines laid down by the acting Homeland Security Secretary, David Pekoska, that came into effect on Monday, 1st of February. Pekoska called the deportations to be limited to suspected terrorists, convicted felons deemed a threat to public security, and undocumented people caught on the border after 1st of November. At least some of the potential deportees have legal cases pending, and one of them was granted an emergency stay by an appeals court judge on Sunday evening. Others expected to be deported on Tuesday or Wednesday. Immigration and Customs Enforcement appears to be pushing ahead with the deportation flight, despite reports that Cameroonians deported to their home country last October and November in the midst of a bloody civil conflict there had been imprisoned, beaten, gone into hiding, or in some cases simply disappeared. A lot of them were locked up in military prisons, which is where they took a whole bunch of people that are arrested by the army, said Mambo Tser, a Cameroonian community activist in the United States. Mambo Tser added, "It's not safe." Lawrence Zebert, a Human Rights Watch researcher and advocate, said, "After scores of Cameroonians were denied asylum in the United States and deported in recent months, Human Rights Watch has documented multiple cases of deportees facing imprisonment, facing abuse, criminal prosecution, and threats by the Cameroonian authorities after their return. Some of their families have also been threatened and harassed." On taking office on 20th of January, the Biden administration ordered a 100-day halt to deportation flights, with certain limited exceptions, whilst Immigration and Customs Enforcement procedures were reviewed to enable focusing the department's resources where they are most needed. However, a federal judge in Texas, Drew Tipton, appointed by former President Donald Trump last June, ordered a stay, blocking the suspension, but not the new guidelines. Drew Tipton's nomination was opposed by Democrats over concerns over his lack of judicial experience and his support for the reinstatement of a Texas social worker fired for using a racial slur against a black colleague. He argued, "It certainly does not evidence a pattern of hostility against anyone or any people who are of a particular race." The case against the moratorium was brought by the Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, who played the leading role in the effort to overturn the November 2020 election result. Ken Paxton addressed Donald Trump's supporters in Washington on 6th of January, shortly before the storming of the Capitol building. "We will not quit fighting. We're Texans, we're Americans, and the fight will go on," he told the crowd, according to the Houston Chronicle. Ken Paxton has been indicted for securities fraud allegedly committed before he took office. He has also been accused of abuse of office by 7 whistleblowers and is being sued for retaliation after having the whistleblowers fired. He is reported to be under FBI investigation for the abuse of office allegations. Ken Paxton's lawyer, Philip Hilder, declined to comment on reports of an FBI investigation of Ken Paxton. After Judge Drew Tipton ruling on deportations, Paxton declared victory on his official Twitter account. "Texas is the first state in the nation to bring a lawsuit against the Biden administration," he wrote, "and we won." Echoing the language widely used to denounce the ransacking of the Capitol, Ken Paxton described the 100-day deportations moratorium as a seditious left-wing insurrection, which he had stopped. In a statement to The Guardian on Monday, an Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokesperson said The agency is in compliance with the temporary restraining order issued by the Texas court. Justice Department lawyers argued against the stay in Tipton's court. The Southern District of Texas, but it was unclear when or whether they would appeal against the court ruling. A department spokesperson declined to comment. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, is seeking to challenge the Texan ruling on behalf of immigrant rights groups. There's a legal aspect to it, and there's a practical aspect, Cody Whoopsie, an American Civil Liberties Union attorney, said. Our individual Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers who may disagree with the new policies of the new administration going to carry out those policies, or are they going to attempt to carry out a more unforgiving immigration policy that they might prefer?
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz Uprising of February 18, 1978.
The Iranian nation accomplished a magnificent feat in this year's 22nd of Behman Rally. I will tell you that according to the report that was delivered to me, the turnout was much higher than previous years. This was the case all over the country or in 98% of the cities of the country. In certain cities, this increase was 50%, in some cities it was 40%, and in some cities the increase was 30%. The enemy sees this movement, but he denies it in his propaganda. In his propaganda, he says that only thousands of people came to the streets. They do not say that millions of people. Overall, tens of millions of individuals poured onto the streets. They do not mention this, but they understand it well enough. The enemy understands this, and the whole world knows that a country whose people are in the middle of the arena in such a united way will come to no harm from the enemy's plots and tricks. Everyone knows this. Your presence at the political and revolutionary scene of the country and the commemoration of the 22nd of Behman of the year 1357, according to the solar calendar, throughout the country was an important political and security move, which was made by the Iranian nation. One should thank God because our hearts are in His hands, legs have moved on your path, and heads have turned towards you. Our hands are stretched towards God, and hearts are in His hands. It was God who brought the people to the arena, and therefore we should be thankful to Him. We thank our dear people from the bottom of our hearts as well. The people chanted the same slogans, the slogan of death to America. As I said the other day, this does not mean the American nation. On the 19th of Behman, I said who the slogan refers to. Now, I would like to say that death to America means death to imperialism and to transgression against the rights of nations. This is what it means. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is Behman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.